This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
And welcome to New Books in Gender Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Yana Byers, and I'm here today with Pallavi Guha, assistant professor in the Department of Mass Communication at Towson University in Towson, Maryland, to talk about her new book, Hear Me Too in India, News, Social Media, and Anti-Rape and Sexual Harassment Activism, out this year, 2021, with Rutgers University Press. And a content warning, as the title of the book indicates, we will be discussing rape today, and this may not be appropriate for some listeners. Hello, Pallavi, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Jenna. Thank you so much for having me here, and I'm excited to have this chat with you and for our listeners as well.
Wonderful. Oh, so how are you today? I'm guessing you're well into spring in Maryland?
Well into spring in Maryland, nice and bright this morning, although we do have storm warnings, so we'll see how the day goes. But it's been a good day to start with.
Excellent. That would be kind of fun, if we got some thunder and lightning to kind of spice up this discourse. Although, honestly, we don't need it. This book is exciting enough on its own. I love spring. A lot of people love spring, and it's about kind of rebirth and renewal, and it feels like it's this opportunity to do something new. You can get a reset. And it feels like that feeds into our discussion today. It seems like a good time to be having this discourse.
I agree with you. I love spring as well. It's the beginning of longer days, more sun, and yes, beginning of newer things and moving away from gloom and monotony.
Yeah, so let's hope that's a metaphor, actually, for the way we handle the issues we'll be discussing today in the globe. All right, so I've taken a look at your CV, and it tells a good story. You had a full career before as a journalist, right, working as a freelancer and then with the BBC and the Times of India. So I'm curious, what made you decide to get a PhD?
Right. So I came to academia, much later. It was not straight out of, at being an undergrad. And so it was kind of funny. So I spent a couple of several years as a journalist. And as you said, I moved around the globe as well, working as a journalist, and it was very fulfilling. Then, I moved here with my partner, my husband, and I was working as a freelancer then as well. And as you know, journalism is a profession which needs a lot of upkeep and evolution, and you constantly have to learn. So I belong to a generation of journalists who did not have Facebook, Twitter, social media when we were working. So I had to reskill myself. So I had to go through the certification programs here so that I was more employable in the market and I could keep working here in the US as well. And, you know, as I was doing that, I came across a program at Rutgers. It was a digital communication program, master's. So I started the program and then I had the opportunity to teach a class as well as a part-timer. And I really loved it. I absolutely loved it. And I was doing this and I was also working part-time, freelancing too, but I loved teaching. And I wrote a couple of papers which got, you know, presented. I presented them at conferences. So that was the other side of academia I got to see, like scholarship-based. So I started, you know, looking around and seeing what is it going to take me to become a full-time academic and a full-time professor and a full-time researcher. So this led me to the path of PhD in journalism. So when I got a PhD, I was already a journalist. But when I was working as a journalist, I never had an educational background in journalism or communication. So it's kind of funny. My background has been in international relations and politics. So that's the path I chose, and then I became a full-time academic since then, since 2013.
Wonderful. Yeah, it's a pretty good gig if you, you know, if it's for you, academia is a wonderful place. I'm interested too, though, in the scope of your work, and it seems that I can see an interest that in this topic and kind of the feminism, sexual assault, et cetera, that predates 2013 as well. So how did you decide to study this topic?
I have always been interested to study sexual harassment and sexual abuse. So this is years before, like when I was a freshly minted undergrad, I had started doing a project, which I could not complete because I didn't get the grant, on women's tourists visiting India and getting sexually abused. But I also belong to a university, and my college undergrad institution, it did not offer women's studies as a discipline. So the choices were like quite rigid. How you have to, you know, go through your degree plan. It was quite rigid. So, of course, I did not have the opportunity to do that then. So when I came back to academia after like several years, for me, it was an opportunity that, you know, now I was able to focus on sexual harassment and sexual abuse. And when I started this program, Jyoti Singh, you know, she had been raped and murdered by then. The hashtag Nirbhaya, the Delhi gang rape, had already happened. So I really wanted to understand, pick up where I had left in early 2000 and understand if hashtag Nirbhaya had made any changes. Because it was well over a decade. There was social media now. And I really wanted to go deeper and understand what are the changes, you know, start with the basic question first. Has there been a change at all? So that's why I decided to choose this topic.
So So this has been with you for quite some time. And that probably, and that explains as well how you decided to situate the most of your study in India as well.
That's correct. That's true.
Yeah. But I mean, this book focuses on India. It's in the title, right? But it also, I feel, it contributes to an understanding of the global situation, and it nestles in with Anglo-Western ideas to create feminism without borders, which is a phrase we know well. Yes,
right. And I focus quite a bit. Yes, of course, it's on India, but you can use this concept, this framework, to understand the global South. So often, you know, when I came back to academia, I was reading a lot of theories, a lot of academic work from the Western scholars and academics, including in feminism. But I just wanted to understand how they could be contextualized, not just for India, but also for the Global South, because a lot of times what works here does not work there due to, you know, various intersectionality issues. It's not just race and class and gender, as Kimberly Crenshaw has pointed out. I mean, it works wonderfully here in the US, but in the Indian context, if I was to talk about, there are other issues such as caste, religion, and even location. That plays a major role. And it's not just India, the Global South, the countries in the Global South, they're very diverse. Digital access, that's also an intersectional concept. That could also be a lens. So trying to understand them and incorporating them in my work, that was something I really wanted to do. And so that kind of helped me.
Mm-hmm. And I see a hole in the scholarship here as well, right? Where there's a lot of work on post-colonial studies, there's a lot of work on feminist theory, but there is a hole in a global access or in like the intersectionality that works in India and how that might apply. So
Yeah. So I was trying to understand that gap and propose something that is going to, you know, possibly take a path and we get, not just me, but other scholars as well. When more people start working, we can have fill up those gaps.
Yeah, and I that definitely is it's working here. I'm seeing that your work contributes to a broader discourse as well that I think we'll use for some time. All right, let's talk about your source material. So the study focuses on social media, and that's a source that I can't imagine working with. It seems like it has so many pitfalls. I'm terrified of it, and you just jumped in. So can you comment on like how you chose to use it, how you made those choices, how you approached the subject material? Just tell me how it was to work with this.
With the social media content?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I was in two minds, honestly, when I was looking at social media platforms. And when I started doing the primary research, it was around 2016, 2017. So there, some of the platforms that are around now, they weren't around. So, and also in the context of India, I had really had to choose which platform was more popular, more people were on it. So that's why I decided to go with Facebook. And this is before, like, Facebook pre the Cambridge Analytics scandal and pre Cambridge Analytics discussion. So some of the APIs were still available, like how I could use and download their data. So what I really wanted to study were all the feminist pages and feminist accounts, the larger ones in India. What were their discourse? What were they talking about? When were they formed? Were they formed before Jyoti Singh's rape and murder, or that is something that happened after Jyoti Singh's murder? And how? What's the kind of conversation they were having on their pages? So I really started with going technical first, choosing the top three or four pages. I think I chose top three pages. Top three feminist pages, and then I chose also the feminist groups, which were open, and I used an API to download that data, which was possible then, before Facebook locked everything up, and that was a lot of information, because most of the people in India, they are still comfortable using Facebook and WhatsApp. So I got the data of how many people are there, you know, what percentage of people are on Facebook, and what percentage of people are on Twitter. And WhatsApp was kind of opening up around that time. It was becoming popular. Now WhatsApp is the most popular platform. It's closed, but it's the most popular. And that's why I chose Facebook. At the same time, when I was doing the interviews, other than the social media platforms, I asked some of the feminist activists as well, what's the platform you're most comfortable in? What are you using? So that also helped me get a sense that they really like Facebook. They like to use Facebook because of the accessibility and also to be able to write long posts, not being limited by 140 characters. Then it was 140 Twitter. So it was overwhelming, but I'm just thankful that it was not locked up, unlike now.
Sure. Yeah. Well, and there's a different kind of discourse you have on Facebook, right? Like there are things you do on Facebook that are different than what you do on Twitter or, you know, I don't understand TikTok and I'm going to keep it that way, you know, or Instagram. There are different ways, but Facebook seems to be the right platform for this discourse. So, but there, you're still dealing with, I mean, in some ways these faceless, like disembodied voices, which I find to be interesting. Did this ever strike you? Did you have any thoughts about that?
So I decided not to look at the identities, like the people who were posting or engaging. A, because, you know, there are ethical issues and concerns. They don't know that they are open. A lot of times they don't have the knowledge that it's open pages, like, or open accounts. So I did not want to use that precarity to kind of look at their identity. What I really focused was on the messages that were being posted and the kind of interactions. What were they talking about when it came to rape and sexual abuse? Did they want justice? Did they want, you know, to make public spaces more safer? Or did they want policies? And if so, then what kind of policies? What kind of justice? Or, you know, they were... A lot of times there were posts which were co-opted, like they were used for other purposes, for political campaigns. So that's why my focus was completely on the messages and not the people who were contributing to the messages.
And then, of course, you conducted interviews where you were able to link with people. So who did you talk to?
So I spoke with 75 journalists and feminist activists. Several of them were from rural areas as well. So speaking with the journalists, I am a former journalist. I spoke with several of my colleagues. And some I wanted to, you know, also speak with others who were not my colleagues. Because it's a different kind, who were not my former colleagues, different kind of interaction. So I reached out to them through LinkedIn. I used Facebook as well to recruit. And as far as the feminist activists are concerned, I reached out to several through Twitter, Facebook. Some, especially the rural feminist activists, my former colleagues helped me quite a bit because they had interviewed, they had knowledge. So I was able to reach out to them through my former colleagues as well. They're journalists, so they helped me put in touch. So I spoke with them before the hashtag MeToo happened and after the hashtag MeToo happened. And I spoke with several, you know, new folks as well after hashtag MeToo happened. And that helped me to get a sense of not just how after 2012, the feminist anti-rape and sexual assault and abuse, feminist activism had changed, reporting had changed, but what impact did hashtag MeToo in after 2017 and hashtag MeToo India after 2018, that influenced the activism as well. And how were they incorporating in their work?
Was there anyone that you excluded from this discourse? Anyone you didn't want to talk to?
Yes, I did. I consciously decided to exclude groups, women's groups, which were affiliated, formally affiliated with political parties. And that comes from my personal experience as a journalist. You know, I have mostly seen, and I've also written about that as a journalist, that they always, you know, they always align with their party's discourses and their party's policies. So anything I ask, it would the conversation would be more political and less on anti-rape and sexual violence activism. So that was a conscious decision.
That's a very interesting choice, and you explain it in the book a little in a bit more detail, and it makes perfect sense to me. I don't know that I would have thought about it, but I guess that's why it's your work. It's very interesting, and I got the feeling that these are these interviews, you're doing them over a long period of time, as you said, before and after Me Too, but also that you put a lot of time in with these people. I felt that you really knew these women.
And it was not just me who knew them, they knew me as well. Because as a feminist scholar, I believe that they are not just my participants. This is not I who's interviewing them, but we are having a conversation. And I spent with them, 40, 45 minutes, for each of the interview segments. And then every time it would be like, okay, they would ask me questions. And one of the questions some of my rural feminists asked me, activists, they asked me that, okay, tell me about what's the situation of, sexual abuse and assault in the U.S.? You're there. What is it about? We never read about it. Do you have a problem or do you not have a problem? this is like, having a conversation like we are having now. And I still keep in touch. With some of them, I still keep in touch with them. So that helped me. And one of the things I just want to say aloud, they had nothing, they had no expectation, as in, every time I would say, I'm taking a lot of your time, or do you want to revisit? If you are not comfortable, we'll not talk about it. It's like, no, I want to talk about it. And, they had no expectation, as in, where are you publishing? What is going to be the outcome? They were happy to share about their work and the problems that they were facing. That was also important for them.
Wonderful. I can see that comes through as well. And this is, it's a question I wanted to get to later on a broader framework, but let's start here. That also speaks to the idea that there is a dialectic between media and consumer media and subject media and participant, right?
Right. Yeah. So there is a dialectic between both those, those two platforms. But what I understood was, for the feminist activists, how they were navigating the social media platforms, especially Facebook, for them, it was more valuable in their dialogues and dialectic with those journalists that they were having, especially when they, they needed to seek support, help, if they had to reach out to an official, if others were not taking their complaints, or they had to reach out for support. It was through these journalists that worked and not through the open calls on social media platforms.
All right. And so you engage directly with your decision to refer to your participants as victims instead of survivors, which is an ongoing discussion. And I'd like to hear your rationale on that.
Sure. So I asked the feminist activists I spoke with, I asked them directly, how would you term your work? Like, are they victims or, are they survivors? Or a lot of them were survivors themselves. So everyone had a different thing to say. Some of them said that, we would like to be called survivors because we have survived, we have come out strong, and we have survived the ordeal. Others said that, yes, we have come out strong, but I have been victimized. I am a victim of that situation, of that incident. So I would like to be called a victim. Yes, I have survived, but, I am still a victim. For the rapes that I discussed as part of my discourse and to understand the news framing on those rapes, how the news media, they were kind of discussing them. all the rapes that I discussed, they also ended up in the victims losing their lives. So they could not speak for themselves. So because they also lost their lives, I have turned them as victims. So that's a decision I have taken. But for my other participants, it's something I ask them directly.
Mm-hmm. So while we're on terminology, you use the word rape. And this is another issue that about which there's a lot of discussion. Really highly contested idea of using the term rape instead of sexual assault. Can I ask what your rationale is for that?
Sure. So I use sexual assault as well as one of the terminology, sexual harassment, sexual abuse, and rape. So I do think that sexual assault is a more broader term where you could also include like other sexual violence and a lot of times sexual harassment is also included in that terminology. But I decided to use the term rape because, again, when I was having a conversation with my, especially with my feminist activists from the rural areas, they use this term. They don't use... So I translated, right? So they don't use mm-hmm. the term sexual assault. So there is a term in both Hindi and Bengali which translates directly to rape. So that's why that was one of the reasons why I decided to use the term rape. Mm-hmm.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
All right. And so, in your introduction, you explain how you chose the rapes you wanted to discuss. How was that? What was your decision process?
So my decision process, of course, I wanted to understand how Jyoti Singh's rape and murder that made that is termed as a watershed moment, both in scholarship and in activism, as well as news media, how social movements work. When you remember, I was talking about as a newly minted undergrad, during my undergrad days, I was interested in doing a study on sexual abuse and sexual assault of women tourists who were visiting India. So after I had graduated, and I think around that time I was doing my first job as well, there was a rape and murder of an Indian woman in one of the bigger cities. She was raped and murdered by the driver of her for pickup car, and it's that period when the IT and ITS sector was booming in India, and she had night shift. She was either returning home. She was going to work, and she was raped and murdered. So around that time, there was a huge outcry, and there were some policy related changes that happened, like the organizations, they implemented a few changes that women were to be, you know, there would be other people in the car, and, you know, if there were night shifts, they would be given some, you know, there would be a specific time when they would be offered night shifts. So, you know, you could directly see that her rape and murder, it had some kind of an outcome, a policy related outcome. And in 2012, we see that happen as well. In 2016, a Dalit woman was raped and murdered in Kerala. She her rape and murder was termed in the media as the other Nirbhaya 2. But I looked at the discourses on social media sites of the larger, like, you know, the feminist groups as well as the news media. It wasn't even 50% of what, like, you know, after Nirbhaya's rape and murder happened. So now she belongs to a marginalized community. She belongs to a location which is further removed from one of the larger cities, one of the capitals. But she was, for the first couple of weeks, she was termed as Nirbhaya 2. So Jisha, that's her name. So Jisha. But there was no, I would say, either policy outcome or a concrete public narrative and public agenda. So that's why I wanted to study, like, why is it so? Why did that happen? And to understand what are some of the factors that influence, you know, creating a policy, creating a larger public narrative.
Mm-hmm. So the policy outcomes, though, that you're talking about, that I'm seeing, tend to focus once again, and as always, and as everywhere, on limiting women's choices and on teaching women to avoid being raped instead of, you know, the other option, perhaps suggesting that people not rape. And you talk about the framework you use to get at this. So would you comment there? Can you explain this to me?
Yes, of course. And I want to explain this not in my words, but in the words that one of my rural feminist activists, her name is Shutapa, she shared with me. So I was speaking with her after hashtag MeTooIndia happened. And I was asking her, tell me something about it. Like, you know, how are the younger girls and women in your community? How are they reacting to it? I'm sure they have access to social media platforms and digital devices. And she said, oh, yeah, they know what is happening. It's not that they don't know, but they can never share their sexual harassments using those hashtags. And I asked her what you just asked me, like, why? And she said, it's because their families in well-meaning ways would limit access to public spaces. So if they were getting harassed on their way to educational institutes, or if they were getting harassed in the educational institutes or workplaces, then their families would say that, okay, your cousin or a male member can accompany you to the public, to, you know, accompany you. Or you can complete your education through distance learning, or you can just, you know, you don't have to work. So it's basically limiting their access to public spaces. So teaching them or helping them not to get raped. And that was a conversation I have also heard growing up, like things you do to avoid not getting harassed, not getting assaulted, right? And that's pretty much there as well still now. Even though there is access to social media sites, there are these specific hashtags that you could use. But we have to recognize that not everyone has the privilege to do it. It's a privilege.
It's definitely a privilege. And I think, though, the we also see with policy, it just fundamentally shows sexual assault of all forms, kind of how that still tends to be viewed as in some ways a property crime or an honor crime, right? This is not about the damage to women themselves so much as to the men around these women.
Yes, and that was something that came up repeatedly when I was looked. So there was no social media when I talked about Pratibha, who was raped by the driver of her car, like her pickup car. And there was no social media then. This is back then. But I was reviewing the framing of the news reports, and she was married. It was framed as if, you know, it was more heinous, as if, you know, and the pain that not just her mother was going through, but also her husband. And there was a lot of focus on this. It's the honor of the family, the honor of the family that was taken away, the honor of the family that became part of the discourse.
And I'm interested in the difference. I mean, obviously, in a country as huge as India with a staggering population, there's also this amazing difference, really astounding difference in rural locales and these massive urban cities. So you discussed the difference between the way rural and urban women and rural and urban feminists saw the impact of the Me Too campaign, right?
Right. For the urban women, especially who were able to share their sexual harassment, sexual assault at workplaces, not just, you know, from recent years, but also like from several years ago, 2008, like early 2000, late 90s. So that gave them a space. In fact, I talk about a couple of urban women specifically working who were and who still are in the news industry. And how when they had approached their organization, nothing happened. They did not get justice. Some were forced to leave the organization. And this space, the hashtags and the social media space, that gave them a platform to again voice their, their experiences, to share those experiences and let the larger public know, the larger audiences know. As compared to that, for the rural feminist activists and the rural women, they saw it very differently. Because like I said, not all of them had the privilege to use those social media platforms using the hashtags. And I specifically talk about a rape survivor. She was raped in 2017 by a political leader. And in around 2018, a rural journalist interviewed her. And he asked her specifically if she was going to use the social media platforms to get justice, to seek justice for herself. And she said, "I don't have a phone and I don't watch TV. And I wanted to get justice, of course, but I lost my father." So there is like, you know, kind of a disconnect. And there was an attempt on her life in 2019. And her mother, she was injured and she was like the rape survivor. She was grievously injured. But her mother, she categorically told some of the smaller news portals that, you know, "You deserted us 6 months ago and we need you, because if you desert us, how are we going to get justice?" So for them, journalists are still, and news media, that's still platforms which amplify their voices, which help them to get justice. And my rural feminist activist said the same thing. If we are ever stuck, if someone is not taking a complaint and we have to pick it, or, you know, others are not taking our complaint, we can't file an FIR, it's our journalist, the journalists help us. We reach out through WhatsApp. So they aren't on open platforms asking for help, because a lot of them, A, they feel burdened to use the social media platforms, B, they don't have the bandwidth. So it's a choice between doing grassroots activism, grassroots helping others, or being on social media sites.
And so what are the differences in the rape myths about these groups of women? So actually, let me back up a little.
Sure.
What's a rape myth, first of all?
So rape myth is a concept that I borrowed from here, from the Western scholars. They have written not just now, but from the 70s and 80s as well. So rape myths are basically frameworks that either a victim is, you know, there's a dichotomy, there's no gray area. Either the victim is a virgin who has been raped and who is now, her life is completely in shambles, or the victim is a whore and she totally deserved this. So mostly it works in this dichotomy. So what I've really seen, and even through the interviews I understood, that after 2012, journalists, especially in India, they were trying to refrain from using the rape myths, especially the horde framework and victim blaming. At least they were moving away, because they did not want to get called out on social media platforms. So they were being being very I would say, you know, they were at least trying to move away from that framework, so that they knew that they should not be using that victim blaming and poor dichotomy. Mm-hmm. And that happened after 2012. However, there are other rape myths still, and not all the time you read about them in the news media. It comes through the conversations, like, you know, in rural areas or semi-rural areas, oh, such things happen. Because the audience or the readers of these larger newspapers, it's mostly the urban Indians or the urban audience. Or, you know, we can carry it later. It's okay. Our audience is not going to be interested. So deciding whose story gets to be told and whose doesn't. So that also influences the rape myth.
Right. Yeah. Very, like, then that kind of, who's deserving is another thing you talk about, right? Which we'll get to in a minute. And I mean, these rape myths also lead to an outcome, because, you know, if this was a good woman who did not have it coming, then her life has to be destroyed, right? And it makes it very hard to recover. And so you see women getting written into the script as perpetual victim. And broken eternally, right?
Eternally broken. And, you know, she was, and then there is scandal associated with some of the women. So one of the victims talk about how she was repeatedly raped for several years by political leaders. And she, you know, she said in one of the news interviews that I will never get to be the country's Nirbhaya. Like, I will never get to have that place. No one is going to talk about me because I am still fighting for justice by myself, because, you know, her rape was part of the scandal. Mm-hmm. in the sense that, you know, I am not the country's daughter. So that's, uh-huh. Yeah. So, and she said that, and, It's because several people were involved, several political leaders were involved, a political party was involved. So she has been fighting very hard for several years just to get justice for herself. And she repeatedly said, no one is going to fight my battle. I'm not the country's daughter. I'm never going to be Nirbhaya. And if you... Yeah, it's just heartbreaking. And if you read... If you read all the news articles associated, you know, reporting on her rape, and even while she was trying to get justice, it's the scandal frame has been used, like, mm-hmm. a lot of times. The word alleged, repeatedly. So when you use the word alleged repeatedly, you are questioning.
Right. And once again, as I think, you know, I say all the time when I'm doing these, when I'm talking about this topic with writers, for the only crime where you actually have to, where the victim has to prove that the crime has taken place. No one says to someone when they say, my watch has been stolen, you know, can you show?
Yeah.
Do you have a receipt for that watch? Yeah. I don't believe you. Right. That's so maddening. And actually, so chapter 3 is called The Heart Does Not Bleed for Everyone, Selective Outrage and Activism. And it's so important. Right. And I usually try to come up with, like, really clever questions that'll get you there. I don't want to do any of that. I just want you to tell me what happens in this chapter. Just tell our readers what you say. It's so important.
Sure. Yeah. So I gave some of the examples. These are the examples, and these are the stories I talk about. Like, you know, Jisha, who's, you know, for who the heart wasn't bleeding as much by the others, or even her, like, you know, she's known as the Surya Nelly victim. The heart doesn't bleed for her at all. One of the journalists I spoke with, and I write to a large extent in this chapter, he said that right after a year or a couple of months after Jyoti Singh was raped and murdered, a similar thing happened in the city. He belongs to a southern city. And a woman from the slum was raped and murdered. And he asked me, did you read about it, Pallavi? Did you read about it? I said, no. And I read my news very closely. Right. I'm like, no, I did not. I was like, did you hear about it? I said, no. And he said, see, I don't have to tell you more. And I asked him, did your newspaper carry it? He said, no, that's why I'm telling you. We did not carry it. I mean, we had the news, but it was like, you know, pushed back and back and back because she belonged to a slum. So it's, she belonged to a slum. So it was kind of, okay, we'll carry it. We will carry it. And then it was out of the news cycle. But he said, believe me, it was as heinous and as gruesome as Jyoti Singh's rape and murder. And so, you know, we don't even come to know. So the heart really doesn't bleed for everyone. So it's the select few. So how the media chooses and how the social media as well chooses who they're going to fight for, who are they going to light a candle for, who are they going to create a hashtag for. It depends on a lot of factors. It's sad. It is very sad and heart-wrenching. But these conversations just, you know, they kind of point out to the stories that we miss, the victims and, we miss.
Yeah. And let's talk about why we miss some of these. You know, it happened in the slums. In part, this is a person who is not important, but right, like not important. I'm making air quotes. But also the idea that these kind of things just happen in slums. Slums are bad. That's a bad neighborhood. Of course, bad things happen. That's not, how is that newsworthy? It's just reaffirming our prejudices, right?
Right. And even in rural or semi-rural areas, you know, these things happen. These things happen and they are not one of us.
Right.
So majority of the people who are on social media platforms, who are influencers or who do hashtag, you know, who take care of hashtag activism, and even journalists, they always, it's, you know, when the victims or even the survivors, when they're like us, there is more value that's placed. Mm-hmm. So for Jyoti Singh, it could have been any girl, any woman who's working in a large city, you know, was just having another day. It could have been you, it could have been me, it could have been any one of us. So there was, even the public, the citizens, they had more, I would say, more relatable. So the more relatable the victim or the survivor is, the more they become part of the story, part of the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And that is relatable to the readers, which means wealthier, more educated, urban, right? And these are people more worthy of everything, of course, right, including safety.
Right, right. Whose bodies are more worthy and valuable.
Yeah. So we're getting low on time, and there are just a few things more I want to discuss. So just this one, what have we learned from anti-rape feminist movements? What can we do with this?
So a couple of things that I learned. I learned a couple of things. One, we really can't focus on any one single platform for anti-rape and sexual harassment feminist activism. So hashtag MeToo and hashtag MeToo India was mostly focused on social media platforms. It gave a space to women and survivors who had been harassed and assaulted in workplaces. It gave them a space when news media largely failed them because several of their own were involved. It gave them a space. But that's also possibly one of the reasons why we do not see a policy-related outcome yet. There are lots of conversations, but no policy-related outcome yet. Similarly, we cannot only focus on news media platforms because, you know, hashtags, they have the ability to push forward. They have the ability to amplify, right? And we have seen that we have seen the same thing when I was talking about the rape survivor from one of the smaller rural areas, and she was interviewed by rural journalists and smaller portals, but no one really fought for her cause until there was an attempt on her life. So focusing only on news media doesn't work as well. We do see hashtag Nirbhaya and Jyoti Singh's rape, like after Jyoti Singh's rape and murder, there have been a concrete policy, there have been larger public narrative, and it's still going on. Even after, you know, 8.5 years, there are still conversations around it. And one of the reasons that I see, and I've learned that it's possible, it's because of the conscious effort and the conscious interdependence between the two forms. So hashtag Nirbhaya, this hashtag was created by one of the news media platforms. They created this hashtag, they created this name. And social media platforms, it amplified. So it was not just news articles that we were seeing and we were reading, but we were also seeing at the same time amplification of, you know, of protests or, you know, using the hashtag to ask the government or to make policies or seeking justice. So the number, so I analyzed the number of, you know, hashtag related comments on Facebook. Okay, around 2012, 2013, and then using the hashtag MeToo more recently in 2018. Believe me, hashtag Nirbhaya had more comments. And this was when social media had evolved so much already. So you would think there are more users, it's more evolved. You would think that there would be more comments. But no, it was far more. Similarly, for news articles as well, it was far more as compared to hashtag MeToo and hashtag MeToo India. So when there's a concerted effort, we do see an outcome, concerted outcome. Mm-hmm. That's
fascinating, because I would think like hashtag movements would be inherently more egalitarian and like, you know, this is crowdsourced, but apparently no, we're still subject to our media overlords or whatever.
Right? Yeah, and I think it also depends, like I said, the Global South is very different. So India is one of the few countries and possibly one of a couple of countries which in 2019 had a circulation growth of newspapers, and which we see not happening in Europe or in Northern America. There's a constant, you know, downward trend, decrease. So it's an anomaly in itself. So where in a country where the newspaper circulation is growing, you really can't neglect that platform, the relevance, mm-hmm. even though social media is so prevalent now.
Sure, certainly. So what's going on now? So what's your new work? Tell me what you're working on.
Sure. So right now I just completed working on political campaigns in India. There's always an election that is happening, either state or parliamentary. So my recently completed work was how parliamentary elections, during the last one, did they include discussion on sexual harassment and sexual violence? And what if there was any impact of hashtag MeToo or hashtag MeToo India? Because a lot of election campaign is online now. We see a lot of discussion. So what has been the interaction between the two? And or what is the impact of that on policy-related issues or, you know, political conversations? So I just completed that, doing interviews. So right now, I am working on another project, which is similar, but it's different in the sense that I'm speaking with digital strategists and political campaigners, and I'm asking them. So I'm seeing that news and images of sexual violence from rural communities in the states where elections are happening that are being shared on social media platforms, but that are not reported on the news media. And these are being shared by either candidates or by political strategists who work for them. But there is no conversation around how policies are going to be created. So why are you sharing, and who knows, and why isn't the news media sharing? So I'm trying to investigate that and figure out what is the role of sexual violence in digital political campaign, not just on the ground political campaign.
And I mean, and that's an outcome, right? Maybe not a policy, but like a pre-policy outcome.
Right. Or, you know, if it's just used to draw the attention. Because, like, you know, in my previous work, when I was I was looking at sexual violence and sexual violence incidents and how it's used in on the ground political campaign as well as in newspapers. So during the interviews, the journalists said, a lot of journalists said they, you know, a scandal frame is used when it's related to political campaigns and sexual violence. It's either to discredit the candidate or to discredit the safety, like, you know, women are not safe. So that framework is largely used. So I am learning new things every single day.
Oh, and that's great, right? That's so fun. I love the idea that we can keep learning forever. That's the whole point.
That's true.
All right. Thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a really fun conversation. About a decidedly unfun topic, but your discussion in this, your book is it's entertaining as well. I can tell you are a journalist, right? I just want to note that you have a really wonderful writing style. But this is a very challenging material, and the story is largely untold. So thank you for writing it.
No, thank you so much for having me and, you know, giving me the opportunity to share what I learned through writing this book, through this entire process. So thank you.
Excellent. And we will talk when you publish your next one.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.